Let me tell you a story, podcast number 148.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Call me Ishmael.
It was the age of wisdom.
Some years ago, never mind.
It is a truth universally acknowledged. This is
the You don't know about me without you.
Welcome to Let Me Tell You a Story with your hosts, Steve and Becky Lyles. Settle back into your seat, step onto your favorite fitness machine, or lace up your walking shoes, and enjoy stories from a variety of genres and authors.
Hi, this is Steve.
Hi, this is Becky. Welcome to Let Me Tell You a Story. Today, we're pleased to have our longtime friends Lori and Steve Bauer with us. Lori is one of my writing critique partners, and she's joined us on this podcast before. But it's been a while, so Steve is going to read her bio for us. Before he does that, I want to say, welcome, Lori. Very fun to have you back again.
Thank you, Becky. I'm glad to be here.
Lori Bauer loves playing tennis, reading eclectically, and playing tug-of-war with her puppy, Winnie the Poodle. She's read fantasy since she was young and writes the kinds of stories she loves to read. She received her PhD in English in 2003 and taught writing, literature, and humanities for 15 years at the college level and lives in Meridian, Idaho with her high school sweetheart, Steve.
Today we're talking about the second book in Lori's second series, the Utopia series. To get readers up to speed, here's a bit about book one, which is titled Utopia Betrayed. What if, in the 23rd century, Earth has been demolished by a horrific war? At least that's what you've been told. Imagine yourself, as part of humanity's remnant, having to retreat into a city under a dome to escape the devastation. All seems peaceful, benevolent, idyllic. But what you don't know is that the leader of your sanctuary has an endless lust for power and control. Peace is an illusion. Freedom, a pipe dream.
Sounds like an intriguing series. Where did you get the idea?
Well, it's interesting. God brings me sometimes plot ideas in dreams. And I read a lot of science fiction, a lot of fantasy. And I thought about, I had read Stephen King's novel about the city under a dome. And I thought, what would happen if there was a futuristic city under a dome and the earth around them supposedly had been devastated, but they don't know that for a fact. They live in the 23rd century in this sort of isolated, domed city. And what if this controlling leader had banned all religion and decided that, you know, that was the opium of the people and that we don't need to have any kind of religious ceremonies? In other words, they want him to be the god. He wants him to be the god. They don't want him to be the god. At least they don't. They find out they don't. And so what if he just rules with an iron hand, iron fist, and has a list of very strict rules they must follow, and even down to loitering or speaking out of turn or those kinds of things as minor offenses can be dealt with harshly. So I just thought, wouldn't that be an interesting plot for a novel? So, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it is. I've read it. You haven't.
You are right.
While you're writing this series, how much research is involved since it's futuristic? Is your info source your imagination?
Well, it's kind of a combination because I am not as technologically savvy as my husband is, but I still can research online quite a bit, and that's what I do. So it's kind of a combination of trying to imagine what life in the 23rd century might be like after a devastating war. So I did a lot of research into what a futuristic refrigerator even would look like, or a futuristic car might look like, or how they might have a dance club even, or what might be their entertainment if they can't, if they banned all religion and this dictatorial leader says, well, we can't have any electronic input because that's not city-sanctioned because it might cause people's imaginations to run wild, and I might not be able to control them. So I had to look into things like, you know, futuristic virtual reality arcades. And I thought, well, then there wouldn't be any lyrical music. It could be classical music or music with a beat for the dance clubs, but no lyrics, because that might incite emotion. And he definitely doesn't want emotion incited in his human subjects, so to speak. So there were a lot of things to look at. I looked at some psychology issues. I looked at technological issues. I was imagining things like a flying taxi and things like that. So, yeah, you have to look into the sciencey side of that to find out if that's even possible and what that might look like. And so, yeah, it was fun. But yet, on the other hand, they still have to have the basics, like they grow their own food, and they have to, because they're under this dome, they have to have their own crops and that kind of thing. So there is that issue as well. Otherwise, how can they sustain themselves? And then where I set it, which is in the 23rd century state of Nevada, where there would be mines so they could get minerals and things. And of course, he wants them to be able to spend their money, this money that they're making at their jobs. So there's jewelry and there's very luxurious type furniture and things like that that the city has to be able to produce. So all of that was kind of fun to research. I did a lot of jewelry research, and my daughter-in-law is a jeweler, so I kind of tapped into her expertise. So there was just a lot. There is a lot. You think, oh, science fiction, you can make up a lot of stuff, but it better be logical and it better, you know, have some kind of solid state ability to it that people can relate to it and say, well, that just doesn't make any sense, or that's illogical or whatever. So yeah, there is a lot of research involved.
Needs to be believable.
Yes. Thank you, Becky. That's right.
Your city sounds like a lot like a cult and a lot like a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would say it's both.
But somebody in that city, they would have all that stuff to buy. Could they travel? Or is that's a no-no problem?
Well, what they have been told is that outside the dome lies a wilderness, that Earth has been totally devastated. And in this wilderness lives things like mutated beasts, and the Earth has been scorched, basically. And so there's really nothing. He's done that on purpose to discourage them from wanting to go outside the dome, and that the air is supposed to be noxious and the soil is supposed to be toxic. And so they really have no desire, because they've been taught from the time they were in school, that the wilderness is a dangerous place with terrors beyond imagination. So, nobody leaves.
I've heard a rumor that Steve helps you think through plot possibilities. Is that true?
Definitely, yes. In fact, he, unlike me, got an A in physics in high school. And so I rely on him heavily when I'm saying, well, does this make sense to you? And he reads through that and goes, well, yes or no. You know, on the current would do this, or it would make more sense for the machinery to do this. And so, yeah, he's very helpful and in that respect. He also finds other things that I think are right, and he goes, this wouldn't happen. And then Becky finds more of them when she reads it too. but yeah, it's you've got to. I mean, you sit there in isolation as a writer at your computer, and you're thinking up what you think is great stuff, but then when somebody else reads it, they don't get it. So you've got to be aware of your audience right from the start. I mean, you can't be so egotistical as to think, well, this is just the way I want it, and I can't have it any other way, because then you won't be a very good writer if you don't target your audience.
How do you target your audience?
Well, it was different for this series than it was with the fantasy series. The fantasy series was for 10 and above if they were reading at grade level, and this one is for young adults. So that shift in audience really caused me to want to, with my beta readers, use young adults as my beta readers, because they're the audience that would be attracted to this, and they would have a different perspective and a different outlook for what they like and that kind of thing. So you really do have to be aware of your audience. Sometimes they don't get to see it till it's in a more finished form, but I can still make lots of changes, and I do upon their suggestions, and they have some great suggestions. So yeah. Yeah, you do have to be aware of your audience. You almost have to have the reader over your shoulder the whole time you're writing, even on the rough draft, because you can't say, well, I like it just the way it is, and it makes perfect sense to me, and then, you know, it will never get read. That's the way, your attitude. So.
How many times do you rewrite? Is that the word?
Man, I don't even count. What I do is I do a lot of, the gals in my critique group give me a lot of input for things that they think would add to it, or things they think don't make sense or are confusing or whatever. So I do that initial rewrite after I get their feedback. And then I let it sit for a while, because if I look at it right then, I won't see those glaring errors or those miscalculations with sentences, or even sing-songy or similar sentences. So I let it sit for quite a while, and then I come back to it. And I'm always going back to the earlier chapters and rereading them and rewriting them. And I'll even read out loud, because sometimes you don't see the sing-songy stuff unless you read out loud. Yeah. So I bet you I revise at least 100 times, which sounds like a lot, but
it does.
It is very time consuming. The initial rough draft, boy, just crank that thing out very quickly. But the rewriting takes months, basically.
How do writers who kick out a book a year or a book a month, how do they do that?
That's a really good question. And to be honest, I'm not saying that their writing isn't high quality. They may have been doing this for longer than I have, be better at it. But I am always been a slow writer. And I feel like, unless, my grandma used to say, unless your thoughts can percolate, she was from the South, so they had to percolate. She says, you gotta let your thinking percolate. Then I don't really think it's the best I can do, and I want it to be the best that I can make at that particular time. And it's interesting, because I was going back and rereading. I had spoke to a group of fifth and sixth graders for my grandson. They have some budding writers in there, which I just received a whole bunch of thank you, very cute thank you notes, which I'm going to follow up on. But anyway, they wanted to ask me lots of questions about, you know, how do you publish and all this and that. And I realized that reading I read part of the Fairy Wars to them, the part of the chapter or whatever, I realized how far my writing has progressed since that first book, and going, well, that's because you keep at it and you constantly challenge yourself to get better and better and to broaden your vocabulary. That's something else that I think is really important. And that best way to do that is to read, of course. But the second best way is to get one of those prop up things that on the dictionary.com or something gives you a new word every day, you know, so that you're constantly broadening your vocabulary. But yeah, I think it's encouraging to see. We all as writers will get better and better with time. So yeah, I think that's a secret. I'm telling you lots of little secrets here.
I'm never going to tell anybody.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I'm curious, what do you enjoy most, plotting or creating characters? Or, because this series is set in a futuristic dystopian society, what about designing your character's world, which is, of course, the plot world? What's the most fun for you?
That's difficult, because I like it all. I like all of it. I like the imaginary part of it, imagination, where I can just see my characters and see them in the setting and see how they would react to different parts of the story. And then how sometimes I even at night dream about them, and they take me places that I couldn't have imagined. So my characters become very real to me, which is so neat when that happens. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm working on the third book, and right now I would say I'm focusing more on the heart, the characters' hearts, their characters' motivations, the characters, because the setting has already been pretty much set up. The plot is pretty much there. I know what's going to happen, but I'm trying to get deeper into the characters in this third book and really make them people that make readers go, oh, wow, that's a neat person, or, oh, wow, that person has a lot of heart, or whatever. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do in this third book. We'll see how that goes. But I think to start out with, setting, of course, was the most important thing. And that was fun, because you do lots of research on what would a dome city look like, and what would they have to have in this city, and how would they their day-to-day life be? So that was probably where you start, pretty much, is with the setting. And then I kind of knew who my main character was going to be from the first book. And then, she has to have a love interest. I mean, hey, no fun without a love interest. So, so he came along later. It was kind of fun to develop her she's kind of an isolated, lonely woman because her parents have passed away. She was an only child. She is being taken care of by an AI, domestic AI named Gran, who fixes her meals and cleans her apartment and all that kind of stuff. But Gran is more than just an AI. She's actually a human-like connection for Farron, because Farron has no other family. At least she thinks she does. She does have other family, but she doesn't know about it until later in one of the other books. But anyway, so that's the other thing. You've got to still have her interacting with her environment and with her characters and other friends. She does have some friends that she interacts with, but I wanted to set her up as being somewhat isolated. And I think that deepens our desire to know her better, because how does she function when her parents are gone and she only has a few friends and she works really hard all the time? And, you know, she does have some downtime, but, you know, kind of a person is she? Can she stand up for herself? Is she very independent? So all those kinds of things. So that's kind of, I want to make her an interesting character for that reason.
I believe this is going to be a 3-book series, right?
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh. So did you have the overarching plot line from the beginning?
It's interesting because with the Fairy Wars, I almost outlined them and had kind of had a real definite feel for where it was going to go. Not so much with this series. I decided, let's kind of fly by the seat of my pants a little bit and just see what ideas I come up with along the way. And like I say, God sends me dreams from time to time. The plot, I did know what's going to happen at the end. You have to really have how you're going to resolve everything. You've got to have an ending in mind, even if it's a 3-book series. Not maybe the ending of each book, but the ultimate ending of how you're going to resolve this whole situation. But as far as, you know, plotting it out on paper or having a flow chart or any of that, I just don't work well with that. I work better with being more fluid and allowing, and I can always rewrite. I can always change my mind. That's the nice thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not set to a particular framework that I've developed that I can't change if I want to change it. So no, I don't anymore. I used to outline all the time, but no, I don't. I do have right now, I have a list of things that have to happen in this third novel to resolve all the loose ends and all the subplots and make sure that they all have an ending to them. So there is a list of things that as I come to them, cross them off. Then I will say, oh, well, that's done. So let's go on to the next plot point or whatever that has to be resolved. But yeah.
Yeah, I do that. Just list after list.
Yes.
Got to fix this. Sometimes that might involve going back to the beginning.
You know, that was interesting because I went back and read the first book because you wanted me to do a reading on it. And I realized that was going to, what I had in the first chapter, I needed to mention some of the terminology I haven't mentioned in the third book. So it was good to go back and read that and say, oh, well, they weren't really called rebels. They were called separatists. So just some of that kind of stuff that you forget in the 2 years since I wrote the first book.
Right. Or for me, it's that I have changed a name so many times or changed a situation that I forget which one I landed one on 5 years ago.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
The world of 23rd century Earth is a dangerous and deadly place, and Farron knows this better than anyone. She's managed to escape the Dome City and the oppressive rule of Jupiter, but now she's on the run. With the aid of her friend Andor, Farron is determined to visit the wilderness, the surface of Earth that's been devastated by a global war.
So when Farron escapes the dome and runs into the real world, the outside world. You've kind of touched on this, but is she concerned about the warnings she's had? Environmental factors like sunburn, bad air, bad water, chemical damage, or just the harsh existence she might not be able to handle when she goes out there.
She's escaped the city, but she's still under the dome in the forest in the second book. So, in the third book, she does get out into the wilderness. Part of the way through the second one, actually, she is out into the wilderness. So she's still outside the city, but she's in a forest when the second book begins. And so she's still feeling somewhat protected because she knows she's still under the dome. So when she finally exits to the outside world, which is after she visits a magical underground city and everything, she finally does, then yes, there's a lot of fear involved there because she feels like everything will be out to get her, and it is out to get her. So, yeah, a lot of what she's heard is true, but a lot of it isn't. So I'm not going to say any more than that because I want you to be intrigued.
Spoilers.
Yeah, spoiler.
Tell us about Farron's friend Andor.
Well, it's interesting because she thinks that he is an enemy, actually. She thinks that he's somebody she can't trust when she first meets him. So there's a little bit of, she follows him into an underground area and they have this big fight, physical fight, and she kind of beats him up. Anyway, she's surprised to find out how strong he is, but she doesn't realize until it comes out later that he's also on this special S18 serum that they've been given that makes them stronger than the average citizen and faster and everything. So anyway, they have a kind of a rocky start to their relationship. He takes her underground and shows her some things, and she finally realizes, oh, he isn't what I thought he was at all. He's somebody I can trust. So he is her equal in many, many ways. He's somebody that she feels an instant connection to and an instant rapport with after the initial fight and arguments and all that, and they get a solid footing of their relationship. So he's somebody that finishes her sentences for her. I mean, they really have this incredible connection, which will be tested in the third book. So anyway, I'm not going to say any more than that.
The Utopia Abandoned cover is detailed and intriguing. It's like a really great place to explore. Is that how the Earth looks after the global war?
No, this is you're talking about the second book. The first book is set in the Dome City, and the cover of that is, of course, a city under a dome. But the second one is a mystical, magical underground city named Agartha. And some people have likened it to Atlantis, or it actually is a real mythical place. That's an oxymoron, but a real mythical place anyway. And I tried to look up pictures on the internet of it. And so from that, I kind of got my own version. It is a beautiful underground city that was built by aliens many centuries ago. Mm-hmm. And it, as you can tell from the cover of the book, it has castles and there are very strange-looking animals that inhabit that area, and there's also one alien still alive down there. The rest have all disappeared or died off, and then there are also some refugees from the city that also live in that area. So when Farron comes out of the tunnels, they've been in the mine tunnels, and they're trying to find this entrance to this lost city that her mother has left her kind of clues that there's something there. She doesn't know it's a lost city, but her mother has led her basically to the end of this tunnel. And they dig through, and there's some other tunnels they have to go through before they get to the city. But it is a gloriously magical and beautiful place, lit by alien insect creatures of all things. So it's as bright as day, even though it's an underground city. So anyway, that's kind of the background of it, but it is a beautiful place. And
if you have alien insects, you must have a mosquito.
Well, not so much in Agartha since it's an underground city, but yeah, when they get out on this, there's some, there's a mutated, I won't go into too much detail, but there is a mutated mosquito that has the sting of a scorpion that's on the surface of the earth that they encounter, call it a meckle fly. And it's about the size of a small rat, maybe. Oh. Yeah, so it could be a pretty painful sting, I would think. But anyway.
It sounds like the book of Revelation in the Bible.
Yeah, yeah, kind of. That's what I
thought. Do you have a title yet for the third book?
Yes, the last book is called Utopia Redeemed. Oh. And basically, they're going to go back into the city, and what they find there will really surprise them, and they're going to try to liberate the city from Jupiter's grasp. Yeah. So,
cool.
Yeah.
That'll be fun.
You going to give any spoilers on that?
No.
A potentially happy ending to a dystopian
situation. Yes, very definitely. Yes.
Cool. Is there anything else you'd like the readers to know about Utopia Abandoned before you read a selection?
Okay. Imagine that Farron has, in the first book, we get to see the city. We get to see her life, her daily life in the city and what that place is like, and her at her workplace and her during her free time and all of that. But Jupiter has suspected all along, he's been having her followed and has suspected all along that she has joined the rebels, which she does in the first book. So this was her impetus for leaving the city. And so in the beginning of this book, we find her in the forest outside the city, but Jupiter's still looking for her. So, okay. And he has an army of AI guards. He has peacekeeping drones that patrol the city and keep peace. And they can vaporize an individual. In other words, they turn to dust within a few seconds from the drone's laser beam. And so, yeah, it's a scary place, very scary place if you're not on Jupiter's side, which of course she's not now. So.
Yeah. Well, before you read, I want to remind listeners that this is the second book in the Utopia series, and it's titled Utopia Abandoned.
Right. Cradled between two pine branches, I don't move a muscle. 20 feet below, a dozen uniformed guards, Jupiter's personal AI brigade, have fanned out. No doubt their orders are to find me and drag me back to the Supreme Leader, dead or alive. My pulse drums in my ears. Once a principal artisan and master citizen, the highest caste in our domed city, I, Farron Makram, designed one-of-a-kind jewelry. But now I'm a fugitive, hiding in a pine tree to avoid Jupiter's net, a net that's slowly, inexorably closing around me. Don't fool yourself, Farron. You're gonna get caught. While he was alive, my father used every opportunity to taunt me. Now, even as an adult, I can't get his voice out of my head. I've been lucky so far to avoid capture, but my time is running out. Already, the nanobots in my bloodstream are getting weaker, as evidenced by my sluggish clamber up this tree. Jupiter's ominous words still ring in my ears. I expect you to locate the dissidents, then report their actions and activities to me. When I refused, he added with a sinister grin. You will not receive your third nanobot dosage otherwise. That dosage, known as S18, would rejuvenate the microscopic machines inside me, boosting my strength, speed, and agility. Without it, as my friend and principal researcher, Zephron, told me, sepsis and organ failure will result, followed by death, of course. But I'd rather die than return to a so-called peaceful city where a vile dictator determines who lives and who dies. Be it infants Jupiter's decides are less than perfect, older workers he deems past their prime, or those like the separatists who seek freedom from his tyranny. Mercilessly and methodically, Jupiter's army stabs the undergrowth with the butts of their stun guns. Over and over these past 2 days, these advanced, human-looking robots have scoured this forest for me. Their arrival is always heralded by snapping branches and ground-shaking footfalls, which gives me time to scurry up the nearest tree. You'd think they'd try to sneak up on me, but they're not meant to think independently. They're programmed to follow Jupiter's commands, no matter what. Each stomp of their heavy boots makes the branch where I'm perched vibrate. Cringing, I cling tighter to the rough bark. Sweat inches down my back. I have to find somewhere else to hide, but not right now. Nearby, a squirrel chatters, then barks to signal danger. I fight to keep my breathing slow and shallow. The guards flush out a rabbit, and I mouth the words, "Run, rabbit, run! Get as far away as you can." It bounds off, unscathed. I'd run, too, if I could, but I'm cocooned inside an anti-thermal sheet. Through the one-way material, I can view those emotionless machines, but they can't see me, not even my heat signature. At least that's what Andor, my friend and a fellow separatist, told me when he gave me this tech. Even so, I'm scared witless. Below, the AI yells, "Halt!" and they all freeze. So do I. The guard looks up right at me. My breath catches in my throat. Did he see movement in the leaves? Did the branch creak? Am I covered well enough? Silent seconds stretch into what seems like minutes. All the while, I'm sure my pounding pulse will give me away. I gaze skyward at the translucent dome that protects all New Caledonians, as well as this forest, from the dangers of a planet ravaged by war. "She must be in the trees," the guard yells. "Shoot the branches!" "God, if you're out there, help me." My senses are immediately bombarded. Flashes of blue plasma, snaps and clicks, whiffs of burning wood, clatters from sheared off branches. Some of the excised wood drops onto the sheet's slick surface and threatens to reveal my position. Don't know why people think prayer is beneficial. Every time I ask God for something, I get into deeper trouble. Feeling trapped, I start to shake. If the pine needles around me weren't quivering from the brutal barrage, my trembling would give me away. One loud zap sizzles nearby, and my heart rate punches into high gear. Just as I'm thanking my lucky stars I wasn't hit, a searing, excruciating shock shoots up my leg. My whole body freezes from toes to scalp. I've been shot. My muscles contract with painful spasms, including my heart, which dances and then falters. My vision darkens, my fingers twitch, my grip loosens, and I slip from the branch. The protective sheet stays snarled in the tree, leaving me exposed. As I plummet downward, air whooshes past my ears. Branches tear at my green cloak. With a bone-jarring thud, I smash into the ground, and every wisp of air is knocked from my lungs. My brain rattles around inside my skull. I struggle to inhale. Exhale. When my vision clears, a blurry 7-foot AI guard, bulbous-nosed, fat-lipped, with dark pits for eyes, hovers above. Death himself. Muscles paralyzed, I'm a numb lump of clay. This is it, I think. My life's over. As if he's at the far end of a tunnel, the guard shouts to the others, "We got her. Jupiter will be pleased." I wait for the AI to pick me up in his cold synthetic arms, or stomp on me, or yank out my fingernails, or do whatever else Jupiter has ordered. I close my eyes, not wanting to see what's coming next. But nothing happens. A grisly deep silence fills the forest. Bone weary, I start to shiver. Must be adrenaline wearing off, or else I'm in shock. At last, I dare to open my eyes. Bent at the waist, the bulky AI still towers over me, frozen where he stands, his stun gun pointed at my head. My muscle spasms subside. I can move my eyeballs and head a millimeter or two, so I peer sideways at the other AIs. Those in my line of vision are statue-like as well. Chitterings from squirrels and chipmunks resume. My sense of relief, however, is quickly squelched when the ground starts to vibrate. Approaching footfalls thump louder and louder in my head. Oh, what's coming for me now? With a bag slung over one shoulder, a masked black-cloaked figure dashes toward me, dodging trees and bushes with lithe actions. So different from the AI's stilted movements. This must be an actual human. He or she bends over my inert body, breathing hard through the mask. A bass voice chokes out my name, more of a plea than a shout. "Varen!" He knows me. I want to cry, "Help!" But speech is impossible right now. The man removes his mask, and I recognize his symmetrical features and enigmatic smile. Andor. I sigh with relief. He once promised I'd always be safe with him. Gotta hurry. The Separatists can't keep Jupiter's minions on pause forever. He pulls up my hood and ties it under my chin, then removes my gloves from a cloak pocket and slips them onto my hands, both actions that will protect me from the sun. I hope this doesn't hurt. He grabs my arms and slides me out from beneath the frozen AI. Though I'm as stiff as a dead branch, he lifts me upright. Some sensation has returned, but so far at least, I'm not in pain. Adjusting his backpack, he hefts me over his right shoulder, face down, as if I weigh nothing. I'm not surprised. He's on S18, same as I am. I inhale his clean, familiar scent and revel in his warmth. He bolts away, dodging the motionless legs of AIs, left and right. When I regain some mobility, my head bounces up and down in rhythm with his loping gait. The pine cone covered ground whizzes past, his boots a black blur beneath me. He weaves between trees and bushes, and pine needles poke my cheeks. The sun strains through the dome and tree canopy to stab the ground with shafts of light. I'm grateful for my hood and gloves. Since the war, Earth's sun is able to burn an individual in a few minutes. Gow! I grow. I'm trying to say go bag, but I sound like a frog being electrocuted. My camouflage pack containing food, water, and other necessities is still in the tree. At least it's well hidden in the branches, and AIs can't climb. Somehow, Andor understands what I'm trying to say. While skirting some rocks, he adds, I'll come back for your bag later, once you're out of harm's way. So many questions swirl in my head, none of which I'm able to ask. How'd you find me? How'd you know the exact moment I needed you most? What's your plan to hide me? Andor stumbles, then stops. He shifts my weight higher on his shoulder and adds, You're probably wondering how I found you. He inhales deeply again and again. Your locator pen was activated this morning, so we monitored your whereabouts. I'd forgotten about the emergency beacon / pen light in my pocket, a tool the Separatists gave me after I joined their rebel group. In my struggle to get up the tree and hide, I must have accidentally activated it, which probably saved my life. I hopped on a freight train and followed your signal. He clears his throat and jogs forward. Seems I arrived just in time. Panting, he adds, By walkie, I asked Jabari to pause the AI's programming. My arms and legs tingle as the stun gun's effects diminish. I wiggle a forefinger to make sure it works and tap Andor on the back. He comes to a standstill, huffing a little. Think you can walk now? My baby, take it slow. He lowers me to the ground and steadies me with both hands. His face close to mine, his warm breath bathes my cheeks. Electric currents that have nothing to do with my stun gun injury race through my body. I can't help but smile. He returns my smile and pulls me into his arms. I stiffen till I realize our illicit display of affection isn't being monitored by cameras, AIs, or drones. I relax and hug him back. Stepping back, he wraps an arm around my waist and swipes a hand across his sweaty forehead and wavy blonde hair. This forest, like our city, is as hot as Hades, despite its shade. Not having showered in days, I must look and smell awful. My cloak is caked with dirt and sap, and my greasy hair must be thick with pine debris. My face burns from shame, and I button my veil across my face. But Andor doesn't seem to notice. So good to see you again, Farron. Annoying tears fill my eyes. I don't respond, afraid to lose the tiny bit of emotional stability I'm hanging on to. All of a sudden, my knees give out, and needles seem to dance across my forehead. Andor props me up with both arms and holds tight, which makes my heart beat wildly. He inches me forward. I try to help by willing my feet to move, but they don't appear to get the message. Try to push yourself to move faster, he murmurs in my ear. Once they're free, those guards are going to scour these woods for you. Jupiter might even send out drones. Eagle-shaped peacekeepers? I hope not. They've flown over a few times, and I've evaded them so far by hiding under the trees. Where? As if he's reading my mind, he answers, I know a place they won't look for you. He drags me onward till my body begins to respond. I concentrate on making my feet support me while secretly thanking what's left of the nanobots for helping me regain my strength so rapidly. I scrunch my shoulders, wiggle my arms, and rotate my neck. Nothing seems broken, although my back is sore. I think I can run now. Let's go. He releases his grip. Andor takes the lead, leaping over logs and evading brush. I try to keep up, but the distance between us widens till he slows his pace. This way! He veers toward a thick patch of bushes and picks his way through waist-high undergrowth. When I catch up, I do the same. He halts at a rocky outcropping, shielded by a thicket of brush. Here we are, he pushes aside some branches to reveal a hole, barely large enough to fit me. Small bones lie scattered around the opening. Did something die here? This is the only spot I could think of, where the guards won't look for you. I stare, wide-eyed. Ah, you've got to be kidding. Nuh-uh. With a shake of my head, I offer my best scowl. Doesn't he know I avoid dark spaces? Maybe not. I've never told him about my phobia. As a preschooler, I occasionally spent the day with my parents in the mines. I was certain monsters lurked in the blackness beyond their headlamps, ready to eat me. The cave's not as tight as it appears. He releases the branch and it falls into place. It gets bigger the farther in you go. How'd you find it? I unbutton my veil. Escaping a bratty cousin when I was 12, he grins. On a day off, our families came here for a picnic, but I had to make the opening bigger to be able to squeeze inside. What about spiders? I shiver. Your penlight should keep them at bay, his gaze narrows. Would you rather stay in the open? Of course not, I point to his wrist. But won't your tracker give us away? 2 days ago, I removed both my trackers, Jupiter's and my birth tracker, but I'm worried Jupiter could find us both through Andor's. No, Jabari passed on your warning note, like you wanted. Before escaping the city, I left a note under my neighbor's door, telling Andor that, because of me, Jupiter was suspicious of him. He rubs a thumb across the red spot on his arm, where each citizen receives a tracker at birth. Yesterday, I skipped work and told my AI I was sick. Using the Separatist bracelet you designed and its hidden controller, I paused my tracker. Then, while my AI was out shopping, I snuck out of my apartment. Before I escaped, I removed the tracker and dumped it. He shoves his hands into his pockets. Been hiding ever since. Today I came here to find you. That means we're both refugees, both being hunted by Jupiter. I'm sorry you got pulled into my troubles, I sigh. I didn't realize Jupiter was watching me so closely. That's okay, it was only a matter of time before he caught on to my rebel nature. He motions toward the hole and holds back the branches again. In you go. I'll cover the entrance once you're situated. My stomach twists, but I ready myself by retrieving the EB penlight from a pocket. Then I lower myself onto my hands and knees and switch on the light. I tighten my hood and peer into the hole. This is the first time I've seen a cave this small. It's nothing more than a rocky roof with a dirt floor that's about 10 feet long. Just take it one step at a time, I tell myself and try to slow my breathing. With the penlight's cold metal between my lips, I fold my arms to my chest and squeeze into the opening. My shoulders brush the sides and dirt sifts into my face. Roots pull at my cloak. Thoughts of how filthy I'm becoming are pushed aside. I continue to crawl forward, the scent of sage replaced by an earthy smell. With a wiggle of hips one way, then another, and a tightening of my butt, I'm able to sidle through the opening. Am I being shoehorned into a space two sizes too small? My fingers touch a dirt floor. I pull my legs inside and turn around. Taking the penlight out of my mouth, I shine it all around the rock-walled space. A centipede scuttles away, making me gasp. My head brushes the rough roof. This cave, if I dare call it that, has only enough headroom to sit. Worried about disturbing a spider or some other creepy crawly, I madly scissor my fingers across my hood and dislodge a few pine needles. To calm my fears, I focus on the positive. At least it's nice and cool. The air is musty and earthy, but it's breathable. You okay in there? Andrew's face fills the entrance, his mercurial hazel eyes reflecting the pen light's halo. As good as can be expected. Things could be worse, I remind myself. I could be stuck outside the dome in the wilderness where, as my institute teacher put it, terrors exist beyond imagination. He withdraws and slides his bag through the opening. I'm going to leave my go bag with you in case you need it. Or in case you don't make it back, I think with a shudder. I set his pack on the floor beside me. Okay, I'm closing you in now. My heart stutters when he covers the entrance with branches. A wan light filters in till he adds more brush. Without the penlight, I'd be in complete darkness. Scary thoughts surface about being buried alive, so I take deep breaths to calm myself. Can you see my light? Yes, it's a dim but obvious glow. Anytime you hear AIs, be sure to switch it off. Okay. I don't want Jupiter's minions to even come close. The small space is bad enough. Add inky blackness and the threat of being exposed, and I'm certain I'll go crazy. He whispers into the opening. Hang tight. I'll return with your bag as soon as possible. Upon approach, I'll clear my throat to let you know I'm ready for action. He chuckles. AIs can't do that. Be careful. Always. His footfalls fade as he retreats. I tuck my legs to my chest. Then I close my eyes and imagine myself at my jewelry work table. In front of me is a star opal in a shiny silver frame. I replay the steps I needed to fashion it. First, I heat silver tubing and shape it around a mold that's the same size and shape as the gem. Once the metal cools, I smooth and polish the silver. Next, I solder prongs onto the setting to secure the opal. After slipping the opal into its frame, I gently close the prongs over the stone's fragile surface. Under my imaginary magnifier, the opal glimmers in layers of deep blue and sea green. Unexpected tears burn my eyes. I miss my art so much, even though it's only been a few days since I fled the city. Stop it, Farron, my father chides. Enough wallowing in self-pity. Exhaustion seeps into my muscles, maybe a residual effect of the stun gun. Or maybe I'm simply tired. Tired of my father's voice. Tired of living in a superficial, mechanized world ruled by a diabolical leader. Tired of running. I rub a thumb and forefinger across the smooth, heart-shaped pendant around my neck that was once my mom's. How I wish she were here, but she and my father, both middle-caste mining laborers, died in the mines 4 years ago. I stretch out my legs. First checking the bumpy cave wall for insects, I lean my hooded head against it. Then I set the pen light on the floor. No idea how long its hydrogen batteries will last, but right now I'm more concerned with keeping bugs away. My eyelids grow heavy. A little nap won't hurt. Scratching sounds awaken me, and I point the pen light at the entrance. Paws appear through the greenery. A long nose comes next, then a pair of piercing black eyes. At the sight of me, the animal startles, then freezes. We stare at each other for several long moments before it emits a low, throaty growl. A scream bubbles up inside me, but I don't let it out. I've invaded some wild beast's den. End of chapter one.
Wow. That's good reading and good writing.
Thank you.
How can people get your book? How can they contact you, Lori?
Well, I do have a website. It's llbauer.com. There are links to all the books at Amazon on that website. But you can also just go on Amazon and type in LL Bauer, no punctuation, space between the LL and the Bauer, and it should pull them up. Or you can type in Fairy Wars, which is the fantasy series I wrote. That should pull up that series for you. Or Utopia. And there are other books named Utopia, but my series is usually on the first page, somewhere down toward the bottom. And then also I have it in all digital formats. I have them basically across the world in every digital format that you can possibly imagine, Barnes & Noble and Kobo, and there's about 12 or 15 different digital formats. So it's in all of those as well. So anybody across the world who wants to read a book in English can do that.
And we want to say the Bauer is B-O-W-E-R.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much. No S on the end, okay?
After reading Lori's books, I highly advise readers to start with book one.
Yes.
Then go to book two, because... you just need that foundation to go through the series, and I'm sure book three should follow, not be a standalone.
Exactly, and the first book gives you the setup for how Farron lives, where she lives, why she wants to escape the city. So if you don't have that knowledge behind you, you won't understand why she's so anxious to get away.
Lori, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, thanks again, Lori, for traipsing across the city to our living room. And I also want to thank our listeners. Remember, you too have a story. Be sure to live it to the fullest.
Thank you for listening to Let Me Tell You a Story. Please email your comments, suggestions, and submissions to story@beckylyles.com. That's all for now. Tune in next time to enjoy a fresh assortment of stories on Let Me Tell You a Story.